Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A lot of economics is about the numbers, validating what you feel by demonstrating what you can prove. Sometimes, though, the actual economy doesn't care what the numbers are. It just cares what people think. So, what do you think? Are things getting better? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation, seeking to increase American understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, the 7th of April. Great to have you here. We have mentioned more than once on this program that consumer spending accounts for something near 70% of the entire economy. So how we're all collectively feeling about things is far from a trivial question. And with that in mind, I offer these data points. The International Monetary Fund is about to slap a new price tag on all those bad bank debts. The total could reach $4 trillion this year. There was a major survey out today showing corporate CEOs are as glum about the future as they have been since people started keeping track. And yet, there is a certain sense out there, validated to some degree by a New York Times, CBS News poll out today, that things are starting to turn around. As we try to figure out what to make of all these mixed signals, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports that the confusion might actually be a good thing.
These days, a glance at the business pages can give you a sort of mental whiplash. Take this sampling of headlines. Muted signs of life in the credit markets. Great. Then again, after recession, recovery will take years. But hold on. Outlook on economy is brightening, new poll finds.
Confusion, right? There's a lot of confusion as to where we are in the business cycle.
Lakshman Acheson studies recessions and recoveries at the Economic Cycle Research Institute. He says confusion is common at turning points in the economy, and he thinks we're close. Yes, the big numbers, like jobs and foreclosures, are still depressing, but he's encouraged by indicators that predict future growth, like factory orders, as well as more exotic data.
Things that aren't even traded, like tallow, which ends up being used as soap to clean dirty factories. And the way that factories get dirty is they get used. So if we see factory soap sales firming, we know something's happening.
That's right. Your best gauge of the economy's health could be the price of rendered beef fat, which has been rising since December, by the way. It's going to take more than that to convince Pierre Ellis. He's a forecaster with Decision Economics. He says the credit market might be thawing and demand for houses may be picking up, but he's not ready to call a rebound.
If you want to be optimistic, you can see some of those signs. The trouble is things can easily turn for the worse again.
If Ellis sounds like he's hedging, you can hardly blame him. As with the recession, we probably won't know we're in a recovery until it's well underway. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates released his fiscal 2010 budget plan yesterday, which means now the real debate can start over which proposals Congress likes and which ones it doesn't. Tens of thousands of jobs in at least 44 states are conceivably at risk in the Pentagon plan. They include people who would build a next-generation ship for the Navy. The F-22 fighter jet from Lockheed Martin would be canceled. An Army weapons program from Boeing would be cut back. And Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports the political opposition has already started right down at the grassroots.
Cancellation of the F-22 alone could cost Lockheed Martin and its vendors 25,000 jobs. A factory in Marietta, Georgia would go dark, and as many as 2,000 workers who make engines at Pratt & Whitney in Connecticut would get pink slips. Jim Parent of the Machinists Union in East Hartford says they started organizing right away.
We put together a handbill for our membership, the workers in the shop, asking them to get a hold of the White House.
Then there'll be a rally on Thursday with Connecticut's congressional delegation.
Business, we're working with them, and also the Chamber of Commerce. There are a lot of vendors that produce parts, and so I'm sure there'll be no problem getting them to apply some pressure.
And that pressure will fall on receptive ears, says aerospace analyst Scott Hamilton.
Members of Congress are going to be very parochial.
Hamilton points out the pain is spread far and wide, from Georgia to Missouri to Texas to Southern California.
They look at the number of jobs in their district or their state, and they don't want to see those go away.
In Seattle, the local machinists' union won't lose many jobs, since most of Boeing's defense work is done in other states. But union official Connie Kelleher is already sharpening her message.
It makes it even more important to land this Air Force tanker contract. It would be additional jobs that perhaps some of these people at the other Boeing locations could transfer here.
The Pentagon plans to go ahead with that tanker program. It could be worth $40 to $100 billion to Boeing or a partnership between Northrop Grumman and Europe's Airbus. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Passover starts tomorrow night, which means kosher shopping has already begun, this year, though, with a twist. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports there is a movement in the Jewish community to expand the meaning of kosher.
Morris Allen is a rabbi in suburban St. Paul, Minnesota. Today, he's delivering Passover supplies to the neediest in his congregation of 400 families.
Let's see, I can open up a bag. Matzah, grape juice, candles.
It's all kosher, of course. That means the preparation of the food complies with Jewish dietary laws. Allen has started a movement to make sure that kosher food is ethical as well. It's his response to a scandal at a kosher meatpacking plant that took advantage of immigrant workers.
When you buy a kosher product, they should be able to know that it's really a product that speaks to the best of who we are as a people.
So, for instance, that brisket was produced by a worker who was treated well and by a company that respects the environment. He also wants to give those products a certification, what's being called the Magen Tzedek seal. Allen says the seal could help companies during this recession.
People are looking at ways that they can catch up in the market share, and I believe that the Magen Tzedek symbol will become such a vehicle by which we will ultimately elevate food production in this country.
Some in the Jewish community say kosher law is strict enough. But Randy Freed, the manager of Got Kosher, a shop in Los Angeles, says his customers want ethically produced products.
Is it organic? Is it natural? So there's certainly a big movement in the kosher food world of moving towards a more healthy, organic approach.
Freed says he expects business to be brisk when the seal is rolled out later this year, just in time for Rosh Hashanah. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Nothing doing on Wall Street today. The major indices never really had a chance. We will have the details when we do the numbers. One of our favorite, if more obscure, economic indicators fell again today. The Baltic Dry Index dropped almost 1.5%. It's a pretty reliable indicator of the price of, and so the demand for, shipping dry goods by sea. As a falling Baltic Dry tells you, a lot of the ships that are usually moving all that stuff around the world aren't anymore. So earlier today, we got Chris Shodoff on the line from Dubai over in the UAE. He's with the worldwide ship services company GAC there, and we asked him what you do with all those empty boats.
Basically, what you do for longer-term layup is that you try to conserve the ship in a very good way so that it is in good shape and it comes out into active duty again.
What does it mean to lay up a ship? You let the crew go, you shut down the machinery, and then you park it someplace, I guess, right?
Yeah, you have different ways of laying up a ship. You have what is called the hot ship layups and you have cold ship layups. So if you lay up a ship in a so-called hot layup, then you maintain the crew. Normally, you do that up to 12 months of time. If you go beyond a year, I'd say up to 5 years, then it's called a cold layup, and then normally you don't have crew on board. And the longer you lay it up, the longer time it will take you to reactivate a ship after it has been laid up.
Seems like an extraordinary amount of time to take a capital asset like a ship out of circulation, even 12 months. I mean, that's just it's a huge piece of machinery you're taking out of the global trade equation.
It's a lot of things to reactivate, not only the main machine, you have auxiliary machines, you have a lot of electronics on board. It's a lot of things. And then you have the cargo holds, you can have cranes on board. It's quite a massive piece of equipment.
Well, let's say you wanted to lay something up in Asia, a medium-sized cargo container. How much might that run a company?
The cost of laying up the ship is one thing. Then you have authorities who take out port charges and so on. It's hard to give a good answer to that. It could be $20,000 to $40,000 for a 2,000 container TEU container ship. Again, it's very much depending on the location and what type of layup you're going for. It could be more, it could be less.
When was the last time we saw ships in this quantity being taken out of service?
Well, last time you had a large number of ships being laid up was in the 70s. Ships were laid up from 1973 to 1975. Some were taken out of hibernation in 1984-85. So that was up to 10 years later. This time, with the action from all kinds of governments around the world, everybody hoped it's going to go a lot faster than that. And we are shipping agents. We want to see ships trade. We want to take care of ships going in and out of ports around the world. But of course, when things like this happens, we have to be there for our clients, and we try to find solutions for these times as well.
Chris Yodoff is a vice president with GAC Corporation. They're a ship service company. We reached him in Dubai. Mr. Yodoff, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
It's got all the makings of another long, drawn-out Washington insider regulatory hearing. But tomorrow's meeting of the Federal Communications Commission could wind up hitting all of us right where we're spending more and more of our time, sitting in front of our computers. If you've ever wished your internet hookup could be faster or cheaper, this is the hearing for you. The FCC is digging into something called the National Broadband Plan, and Tamara Keith reports it could bring big changes to high-speed access.
The FCC is supposed to explore the most efficient ways to get high-speed internet to the masses, to the places where the major phone and cable companies haven't extended their broadband lines, or where service is mediocre, and to people who just haven't signed on because of price. Art Brodsky with the group Public Knowledge says there's plenty of room for improvement.
You know, you see a lot of prices going up. You see speeds still relatively slow.
He has a directory of internet service providers on his desk. It's from 1998 and has more than 500 pages. These days, the options could fit in a Cliff's Notes version because Brodsky says companies aren't forced to sell space on their high-speed lines to other providers.
Maybe there'd be more innovation. Maybe there'd be more features and prices and faster speeds if they sold line-sharing access to their networks, what we did back in the old days.
But a change like that would bring unwanted government interference, says Walter McCormick, president of the U.S. Telecom Association, which includes broadband providers from small local telephone cooperatives right on up to Verizon. He says the industry spent $60 billion last year to upgrade its networks.
There is nothing that will chill investment faster than to increase uncertainty or to suggest that there might be an increase in risk.
With billions at stake, the plan will no doubt be contentious. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
A lot of the computers we use to get online, broadband or dial-up, have Intel chips inside. That laptop on your kitchen table probably runs on one of the millions of microprocessors the company makes every day. But like it has at most places, business at Intel has tailed off quite a bit.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Intel CEO Paul Otellini. He's an MBA at a company that's been run by engineers since the very beginning. But 25 years in the chip business has taught him all he needs to know, like how he can be so sure that business is eventually going to bounce back.
Think about what you would do differently or how you do your job or how you do your life nowadays without the internet. It's almost incomprehensible. This is something which, in terms of its ubiquity, is less than 10 years old. And yet it is a fundamental part of our life. If your computer broke tonight, would you wait for the recession to end to buy another one?
Interesting you mentioned that, because obviously people aren't buying computers now, which is why you're seeing sales fall and orders to your companies and your factories are down.
Well, they're still buying computers.
Not as many as you'd like,
they're buying about 30% less than they were at the peak last year. But it's still, I could argue, they're 70% of where they were. And part of that is replacement. Part of that is first-time buyers in emerging markets. And part of it is new price points with things like netbooks coming on that allow a more affordable means of entering the world of computing.
So what is new and next for Intel if you have to keep people buying through this recession?
Well, from our perspective, we'll invest in a new generation of silicon technology. which we call 32 nanometers. A nanometer is the width of the smallest line you can build. So 32 nanometers, we're now dealing with things that are two or three atoms wide in terms of how small the features of our chips are. We'll put that new technology in the ground. We're putting $7 billion of our own money into it to build new factories and upgrade tools and factories here in the United States.
Why here? Why in this country?
The fastest way to get a lot of capacity online at the next generation technology is to convert existing factories we had in the United States. To some extent, the recession allowed us to do that. The recession that we're in right now has lowered demand. That gives us the ability to consolidate production into some plants and to take other plants down and retool them. And so the cheapest way to get to a lot of 32 nanometer capacity was to use facilities and the workforce that was already trained in Oregon, Arizona, and New Mexico.
You made a speech a number of weeks ago in Washington.
Yeah.
About the investment that Intel's going to make in the American economy.
Yes.
I'm paraphrasing here, but your message was we have an obligation to invest in this country, especially right now.
That's not quite what I said. What I said, we have an obligation to invest, and we have an obligation to talk about that investment. And I think that we're looking for other firms to follow our lead in terms of making a bet on the U.S. economy and on the fact that this cycle would end.
And are you getting people to join you in that?
So far, it's pretty lonely.
What do you make of that?
I think as a company, we are a bellwether. And that's one of the reasons that you saw us stand up. If you're a bellwether, you have to ring the bell every now and then and draw attention to things. It's also, if in our industry, we are the long lead time investment. So for us to make the investment at 32 nanometers and deploy that over the next 18 months and run product on it, we've been designing for a number of years, sends a very clear signal to our customers and to their customers that they can count on us to deliver new product next year. So if you're a Hewlett-Packard or a Dell and you want to build the next generation of notebooks, you'll put designers onto that this year. They wouldn't be able to do that if they didn't know that we were building these new products. The memory manufacturers around the world all see our investment and know that we are, to some extent, a catalytical technology which starts the whole cycle going.
Paul Otellini, President and CEO of Intel, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You can hear all our conversations from other corner offices on our website. It is marketplace.org. Coming up, when the recession can be really convenient.
When an employer is engaged in massive layoffs, proving that the reason for the layoff was discrimination rather than just financial distress will be more difficult.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial stepped back 2 1/3% today, 186 points, finished at 77.89. The Nasdaq sliced off 2 8/10%, 45 points, ended at 1561. The S&P 500 gave up 2 1/3%, 19 points, finished at 815. Alcoa kicked off the earnings parade. Its shares were down 1.5% during regular trading today, but they ticked up after the bell when the aluminum giant reported stronger than expected first quarter earnings. General Motors reversed nearly 12% today. That on fears the automaker is preparing to file for bankruptcy. Ford shares skidded nearly 7.5%. Reports that banks could be sitting on a lot more toxic assets helped pull down financial shares. JPMorgan Chase withdrew 3 1/3%. Wells Fargo threw off 2 2/3%. Goldman Sachs lost 0.5%. Oil prices fell below $50 a barrel today. Oil shares followed Chevron, poured off more than 2%. Exxon lost just under 2%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale trade inventories for February. The Jewish celebration of Passover begins. And on April 8th, 1974, baseball's home run record held by Babe Ruth was broken. Hank Aaron hit his 715th home run playing for the Atlanta Braves. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
That music can only mean one thing. It's time to hit the inbox. Last Monday, when President Obama put Chrysler and General Motors on notice, we aired a commentary by Kevin Hassett, in which he laid the blame for Detroit's troubles on the United Auto Workers Union. Not a popular viewpoint among Marketplace listeners, Sue Peterson of East Orleans, Massachusetts, spoke for many of you.
GM failed because they made lousy vehicles, not because they paid their workers a living wage. Enough with the union bashing.
Blaze Jackson of Escondido, California, thought Hassett was a little hard on the unions as well.
The UAW didn't force or dictate the terms of fiscal surrender to GM. The corporation willingly signed collective bargaining agreement after collective bargaining agreement, like clockwork, every few years.
We kicked off the month of April with Mitchell Hartman's piece on how far some real estate agents will go to sell a house. Mitchell told us they're hiring actors to make neighborhoods look lived in, people barbecuing, walking dogs, even hiring local Little League teams to play at a nearby diamond. You were outraged. Only one problem, though, related to the calendar. Christopher Richards of Oakland, California, had this to say about our April Fool story.
I was bamboozled. Yes, you took me in. I could see every detail in my mind's eye. The Hawaiian-shirted man at the barbecue, the smell of cut grass and cooking, and the play of unruly kids.
It was pretty well done, but there were some out there who figured David Frum's commentary that same day was the joke. He was talking about why some European governments object to President Obama's stimulus plan. Chet Gardner of Tucson, Arizona, thought he was onto the gag.
I thought your April Fool's Day segment with David Frum was a hoot. Imagine anyone believing that Europeans just hate living in societies where workers get a livable wage, decent paid vacations and maternity-paternity leave, and are horrified that Obama would attempt to get a tiny piece of the pie into the hands of American workers.
No such luck, Chet. You can hear David Frum's entirely sincere commentaries here every other Wednesday. And we are going to end today on a poetic note, a challenge, actually. April is National Poetry Month, so we're going to be exploring the poetry of economics and of work and of money because, yeah, sometimes they do go together. To give you an idea of what we're looking for, here are just a couple of lines from one of my favorites, Philip Levine, and his poem, What Work Is.
We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park. For work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it.
So if you've got a favorite published poem that you think fits the bill, send it along. Marketplace.org is our homepage. There's a new link there. It says poetry. With all that we've learned in the past year or two about enormous bonuses and corporate greed, Ponzi schemes, and just generally depressing truths, it's easy to be cynical. But this next story might take the cake. The recession is giving cover to companies that are looking to get rid of some of their employees just because. Sally Herships reports.
Sadie Nardini managed a New York City yoga studio for the last 2 years. While there, she had to lay off 15 employees. That was half of the workforce. She was told to say it was due to the recession, except that wasn't the real explanation. Her boss had other reasons. Too many men at the front desk.
And she wanted some goddess energy up there, which means some women, apparently.
Or someone looked unhealthy.
Or this person talks too loudly.
Whatever the real reasons, Sadie's boss said to use the economy as an excuse. No one was given any notice. Even Sadie's mom, she worked for the yoga studio, too.
Did they fire your mother?
They fired my mother last week due to the economy. The economy is a scapegoat right now. It's dangerous a little bit.
David Lewis is a human resources consultant in Connecticut. He says on a scale of 1 to 10 for good excuses, recession is an 11.
It is that ripe and that rich for the opportunity to be able to let that individual go who you just haven't been able to figure out a way to let go before.
Lewis says there are many employers who have a worker they should have fired long ago. One example?
Where that person is older, does not have the skills necessary to do the job today. They may have had those skills when they joined the company some 20 years ago, but the job's passed them by.
Dan O'Meara is a lawyer in Philadelphia. He represents employers. He says for employers, honesty is the best policy.
I think it's better that employers tell employees an uncomfortable truth than a flattering lie. Sometimes employers want to say, oh, this had nothing to do with your job performance, et cetera, when in fact it did.
But what about lawsuits? O'Meara says use release agreements to soften the blow. That's a severance package in exchange for an agreement not to sue. But HR consultant David Lewis says that can be expensive.
Even there, you have no guarantee that the person's going to accept it.
Instead of a severance package, Lewis says employers may want to use the economy as an excuse.
Put them into a group of five people you're laying off, a lot easier.
When an employer is engaged in massive layoffs, proving that the reason for the layoff was discrimination rather than just financial distress will be more difficult.
That's Columbia University law professor Suzanne Goldberg. She says you obviously can't fire someone for race, gender, or religion. But both lawyers agree there are a lot of reasons you can legally fire someone. O'Meara says most U.S. workers are what's called employed at will.
Meaning the employer can fire them for good reason, bad reason, or no reason.
Which brings us back to using the recession as an excuse. Human resources consultant David Lewis says, while getting rid of deadweight employees may be a plus, no employer is happy to see their business shrink. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, either a welcome bit of extra help at a time when a lot of people could use it, or this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us. There is a website out there that will say a prayer for you. Three per day, in fact, for $4.95 a month. You send them the text. They run it through a voice synthesizer. Information Age Prayer is the name of the company. All the major faiths, as well as the unaffiliated, are welcome. And they've got pre-selected choices for you, too. Prayers for Economic Stability, they're discounted, $3.95 a month. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow lost 2.3%, 186 points, finished at 77.89. The NASDAQ dropped 2.8%, 45 points, ended at 1561. The S&P 500 gave back 2.3% today, 19 points, finished at 815. Thanks today to Rada B., Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. Coming up next time on this radio broadcast, for some Iraqi refugees, the road to a better life leads straight to Sweden.
Our priority is to get these people into the job market and to start their own lives, whether it's here or in other cities.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.